today's episode, Belia is going to give birth on our
As a favor to the podcast, she did not take the Mexican painkillers.
Welcome to What You Know About RJ, Restorative Justice, Sharing Stories and Skills, a podcast of the California Conference for Equality and Justice. I'm your host, Taharka Anderson. In our last episode, we read the following teaser as an introduction for our next guest. We'll be introducing one team member in each of our first episodes, learning more about them, who they are, and why they do RJ work. What does martial arts, the dimensions of length, width, and depth, and a strong purpose have to do with restorative justice? Today's squad spotlight is on none other than Belia Maeno Saavedra, who is the Director of Restorative Justice in Schools at the California Conference for Equality and Justice. Belia, what are you doing in this description?
It's not quite a doing, it's more like being. So a lot of the work that we do in restorative justice is definitely skill-based and does involve like protocols, mm-hmm. but it's also about how do we want to be, and once we get clear on how we want to be, that then impacts how we show up in the space and makes us more quote-unquote restorative, mm-hmm. although I don't think that we ever arrive fully at being restorative. That description is really about the usage of some of the skills that are in politicized somatics that I find are relevant to this work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome. So being that we know restorative justice is all about sharing stories as a way to build relationships and connections, can you tell us a story about your name?
My name. So I am named after my dad's mom. Her name was also Belia. Mm. It's kind of, it's not like the level of like what Gertrude is in English as a grandma name, or like Bertha, or yeah. like names that we think of like grandmas. But it's kind of an older name, I think. Mm. Like, a lot of people tell me, oh, my tía abuela, my great aunt, my great-great-grandma was named that. Nobody's really named that anymore. Mm. I look a lot like my grandma, and I have a really good relationship with her. So I feel lucky to carry it in that way. And then also, it's supposed to mean beautiful, like from the Spanish root word, but also it... According to people that I know who are from Egypt, you know, like the little game marbles, like yeah. the little balls that you shoot at each other, mm-hmm. that's what it means to them.
Okay, well, a beautiful marble.
Yes, thank you.
Right, so that's the government name, but in thinking about, do you have any nicknames that you could tell us some stories about?
My nickname in my family is Noodle.
Noodle.
Everybody calls me that. Or my sister just calls me Nude, which I do not like.
Okay, understood.
My sister is just one of those people where, you know, as some people where if they make up a nickname for you, it sticks. Mm-hmm. But if somebody else makes up a nickname, it doesn't stick. It
doesn't fly, yeah.
And actually, on our team, I feel like I'm that person where once I start calling somebody something, everybody else does. Facts. But I'm not that person in my family. My sister's that person in my family. So she started calling me Noodle as a kid. And I don't even remember how we got... I think it went from, like, she used to call me Boo to Buddha to Burma to Burmacelli to Burmacelli Noodle. And now her children think that my government name is Noodle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting.
But you're not allowed to call me that.
I won't be calling you Noodle. So, all right, we're breaking the ice just a little bit. So, is there anything that brings you joy or that gives you strength in the work of restorative justice?
I mean, lots of things. Definitely, I feel like our team, for sure. I think, like... having a strong team of people that I really trust and believe in to do work that we know is not easy. And that not only is not easy in terms of endurance, but also is, like, it's simple, but it's not simple. Like, it's weirdly nuanced at the same time that it's also, like, actually very simple and at its core. That's a odd contradiction to constantly be holding. So I feel really good and get a lot of joy from being able to do that with people that I trust who I know can hold that tension. Also the like politicized somatics piece that I was mentioning earlier, I think like a lot, you know, I think this is what, from what I know of you as your friend and colleague and what I know of myself and lots of folks, you know, we're smart people, but also that means sometimes we end up spending a lot of time in our heads. And this is not a practice that can only be done from the headspace. So I feel like anything that helps me connect not only with my body but also my intuition and my own spirit, like politicized somatics through the organization called Generative Somatics, but also spiritual practice, meditation, breath work, yeah, sometimes even like play and theater games, like something that reminds me that I'm like a full system of a person, brings me joy and helps resource me to do the work further.
So in thinking about your involvement in generative somatics, how'd you become interested or involved with that?
A lot of people that I know who I really respect had done it before me, and they were all like, this is life-changing, it's really, really important. And really, I think, you know, I was lucky enough to start doing work in the social justice realms when I was really young, like I was a teenager, and then I had good mentors who were like, we're going to teach you how to do this. Like, they really trusted youth leadership and not in, like, a tokenizing way. But, like, that means that I'm, you know, I'm in my late 30s, but I've had now about 20 years of being in this kind of work. And one of the things in the variety of different contexts that I've done this work in is watching and witnessing and also firsthand living through the ways that, like, my own experiences of trauma or my own experience of conditioning in the body and personhood that I am in the world that we live in impacts my ability to do the work to the extent of the spaciousness that I could. Does that make sense? So, like, watching in a bunch of different orgs, oh, this is how people's, like, conditioning is, like, bumping up against each other, or, like, the ways that we're shaped by race, class, gender, ability, and all those things is, like, making it sometimes find our limits in terms of the impact that we can have collectively or the sustainability that we can have. And somatics was one of the first places that I saw that they were like, no, we have a whole methodology to engage that. It's not going to be fixed by that, but it's going to get clear on, like, what do we want to be practicing and in line with what visions. Because I saw, like, a meme the other day that was, like, a little shady, but it felt true, that somebody said something, I'm misquoting it, but basically they were like, unresolved trauma is not a good basis for social justice work. And I think that I don't completely agree with that, and I might be misquoting it, so I might be disagreeing with something that I'm misquoting myself, but, like, this idea of, like, if that's the only thing that we're founding the work in, it's really, really hard to have sustainability, and also makes it a lot easier to be reactive from that space. So I think a lot of people come into this work because of our unresolved traumas sometimes, or, like, also just the ways that we've seen our communities be traumatized, and we have a desire to make an intervention into that. I think that's really, really beautiful. And the scale of time that that intervention will work at is almost never as fast as we need it to be in terms of keeping up with the hurt that we're carrying. So if we go into this work thinking that it's going to put fully medicine on that stuff without attending to, like, the ways that those things are operating inside of us, it's just, it's not fast enough, because I think a lot of us are working for things that we're not going to see the end to in our lifetime. Like, if we're trying to, you know, have, like, autonomy for femme of center people, especially, like, people of color, women, trans women, non-binary folks, all those things. I'm really committed to that. That's really important to me. And I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime. Mm. So if I was trying to solve that as a way to attend to the traumas that my body has experienced as a feminine of center, woman of color, it's not going to be completely in alignment or like on time, I guess. And I think somatics has a way to bridge like holding that desire and that larger vision, but also being like, and I'm a person and a body and a system that has these needs and possibilities and potentials for new practices now.
Yeah, that's very interesting in terms of how you're right thinking through and talking about right how sometimes in social justice work we're clear on like what we're resisting or what we're trying to dismantle, but there's the other component of the work of like either working on ourselves or working on our interpersonal relationships in the work. And it reminds me of in Adrienne Marie Brown's book, Emergent Strategy.
Who's also a somatics practitioner.
Oh, okay. And teacher. Well, makes sense, mm-hmm. Right? Adrienne was talking about in one portion of the book, seeing like our interpersonal relationships as a front line, mm-hmm. Right? And ever since I read that quote, it was like very like transformative for how I think about like when I'm in organizing spaces or trying to do whatever we call the work is, am I cheating and showing up for folks in a way in which I want, let's say, systems that we're dismantling to show up for human beings, right? So am I just fighting for abolition or trying to do away with punitive ways of discipline, but also showing up with my family members or my friends or people I'm in relationships with in those ways that I'm saying that I'm trying to operate in opposition to. Mm-hmm. And I think it, you know, creates this moment, creates a moment, but also allows us to begin actually shifting the way in which the world operates, right? And understanding that what we're trying to create is not only necessarily outside of us or outside of the communities that we're in, but the world that we're trying to change is actually inclusive of our interpersonal relationships. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very powerful, like thinking about the outside and the inside and understanding that they're both interrelated and dependent upon one another.
Yeah, and I know that her work is more around transformative justice, yeah, versus restorative justice, which is a different show. Right. but one of the things that I really appreciate about her work, but also about somatics as a methodology, is both of them are thinking about scale. Mm. And I think that also relates to what we're doing in restorative justice in schools, where it's like, yes, it's not just this one interaction that two people have that is going to change everything. Mm-hmm. But like, that is a iteration, can be, if there's enough of those,
yeah,
can grow to a larger scale to be like, oh, this is the culture that we have inside of this space, or this, mm-hmm, is the collective impact that we're able to make as a bigger group. And so I'm really interested in somatics, but also in other things, about like what is the balance that we're finding where we're not overemphasizing the interpersonal, because I think we can then fall into a trap of like, well, I'm not racist, no, and I don't have anything to do with racism because I've never done A, B, and C, mm-hmm, right? And then they restrict it too much to the level of the personal. Right. But then I also think being too macro then kind of takes our level of, right, responsibility. Both of those ways, too little or too big, right, only without looking at it with a sense of scale, can become ways that people don't, not only are not accountable, which I think is language that lots of people use a lot, but also I feel like accountability is not only like don't do crappy stuff to people,
right,
or you will be punished, right? Which is a lot of the way I think misnomers happen around accountability, but also like, what is your personal power and impact, and like, what are you practicing? And then it, like, accountability can really be like partially, at least, not only taking responsibility for your mistakes, but also taking responsibility for your like capacity and, mm-hmm, greatness. Do you want to use your capacity and your power in a way that's like that is another iteration of these like poisonous, dominant, exploitative, mm-hmm, disposability type things. And so what I like about what she talks about in her work, and also what Somatics talks about in a little bit different language, is like finding that balance of like, what is your contribution and your vision for the larger sake of the world that you're mm-hmm. trying to build? Like, how can we always be in a conversation that's about scale, mm-hmm. but not making scale take up so much of the conversation that then we're like, oh, we can never scale this into a big enough movement, so we might as well not do it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So in thinking about, right, as we talk about like scale and accountability, and like building relationships and sharing stories, how else do you think generative somatics relates to the work of restorative justice that we do?
Well, I mean, they have an explicit commitment around like and intervening in state violence, right? Or like helping build the capacity of organizers and movement makers who are trying to intervene in state violence. So they have a special emphasis on working with folks like that, mm-hmm. including like surveillance, state repression, including like the prison system, right? Prison industrial complex. And so they see at transformative justice as a big part of that. Again, I think our work, because of doing it in a school context and what schools are ready for, is restorative justice. So there's connections there, but it's not the same. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is possibility there. Why I think that there's like these connections is that every room that we're ever going to be in classrooms with teachers, assemblies of students, are full of bodies that are operating and operating within and impacted by these larger systems mm-hmm. that somatics is trying to impact on a smaller scale, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So like you'll even see, I think, like in a training, you know, like how we learn to like read the room, right? And you're looking out and you can see like the people who are really like contracted and kind of tightened off, and like watching and tracking over the course of the day, like the ways that they might be having little softenings. Insert, you know, like a person who at the beginning is like so sure that you've come to take away punishment and ruin their ability to do their job. And then like if I feel like I'm in my full embodiment and my like centeredness, what I notice that that does is that it relaxes other people's systems a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about this, like where it's like when you show up in a particular way, because we're really, this is another thing that I think is kind of in emergent strategies, like this way that like we're, there's this like network of bodies and network of systems that are responding to each other. So one of the things, even though I like definitely don't teach any somatics in the trainings that we do, it impacts how I show up, which then impacts how people respond to me. So if I'm in a centered place, my organism, my system, my ability to listen differently, to not try to control or react to the ways that people might be in their contraction moments, really influences how they experience me as a trainer or as a facilitator, and then it can help shape the room. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Right, so we've been talking a lot about like generative somatics, and you've used this word of contraction a lot, right? And I know another word that you sometimes use is expansion, right? So can you explain what those two concepts mean?
Well, it's really just like it's a metaphor, and then it's also a literal thing that happens. So all things on every scale of life function in cycles of expansion and contraction, including even like the mountains, right? Or earthquakes are like expansions and contractions, right? But we just can't see that because of the scale that human life is compared to a mountain. But like when we're looking at like a seed turning into a bud, right? Or like a baby in a little fetus nugget, you know, and like how they like to be all curled up, or like my little dog that loves to sleep in a donut shape, right? And then when he's a really good example, when he's feeling more relaxed or when he's feeling more safer, when he's around humans that he trusts, he'll open up and he'll sleep on his side and he'll let you touch his belly, right? So human beings, because we're animals, we also function in that same way. When we're feeling unsafe, when we're feeling tentative, when we're feeling nervous or anxious, all these like quote unquote negative emotions, I don't like labeling in that way, but things that are like emotions that are kind of hard to hold, we tend to literally contract, right? Like for myself, like I get really hard in my jaw, like my jaw muscles get really tight, my chest kind of lifts up and tightens, and that's kind of the way that I have learned a literal like body position to help myself feel like a little more solid and a little more safe, whether or not I actually am safe, because, you know, I can't always control the external circumstances. Or like a lot of children who are assigned male at birth, when they cry and they get that, don't cry, be a man, right? I've seen people in my family do that. The way that they learn, those little kids learn how to block that off, because they're like, okay, well, I guess I'm doing something I'm not supposed to do, a lot of times is like tightening in their throat and in their jaw. And then you look now to adult people who are cis men assigned male at birth, a lot of them walk with like their chin up and tight, and like you might associate that as like, come at me, bro. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's something that they learn probably from a very, very young age that they may or may not even know that they're doing, right? So it's like there's this literal ways that our bodies get shaped and taught and conditioned into contraction.
Yeah.
That might be how we hold ourselves on a more permanent contraction. Those are the deeper ones that require like a lot more work and engagement to help have some opening around.
Yeah.
Through somatic body work in this particular lineage. But then there's also like the mini contractions of like somebody comes in and tells me, oh, this grant that you guys thought that you were off gonna get, you're not going to. And then I'm like, oh my God, that brings up all my childhood scarcity stuff about money. And you just, I'm telling you this story and you could see that my shoulders just went up and tightened towards my ears,
right?
I didn't do that on purpose. That's literally what happens in my body when I get stressed out around money, right? Yeah. But then expansion is kind of like the part that I was talking about earlier with my little dog, where it's like, oh, I feel relaxed. I feel more open. I feel like able to let the, you know, the rubs in, the belly rubs in on all the tender parts that, you know, animals are really instinctively trying to protect.
Right.
That's why they only let like somebody they really trust touch their belly and their organs, right? And so that's like kind of like, how can I be in expansion, like in a relaxed, open, present, connected way of being that allows for new information to come in and new choices or actions to come out of me? So it could be metaphorically we're in a contraction. You know, when we in a budgeting meeting got a cut $20,000 out the pockets, because we got to contract a little in terms of our spending,
right,
like that. Or it could be like a literal my own contraction in the budget meeting because I'm freaked out about money and I have a lot of like poor kid angst, right?
Right.
And then on the flip side, an expansion of we're starting new programs, we're starting a new project, we're like have a new campaign, we have an expansion in that. And that might also bring about a different way of being in my own body system or your own body system that's like open. So, wow, I'm really excited to make these new connections with other folks in the community, stuff like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so in thinking about like when people are experiencing moments of contraction or, you know, there's just difficult conversations, are there any like particular moments when, you know, the different identities that you embody have impacted the way in which you responded to a situation of conflict?
Yeah, so I feel like, you know, I am assigned female at birth. I identify with that assignation, so I'm a cis woman. I'm kind of small. I got a big mouth, like I'm bigger than I am, but I'm little. And so I think like a lot of times, like what that has produced in me in terms of my identity experiences and also like being a woman of color who gets like targeted for lots of sexual harassment as a kid, not as much in like recent years, but also like I just feel like I wasn't, you know, I'm all the ways that like teenagers are like in these streets and then have, not that that's bad on them, but just like that, I remember just feeling like unsafe a lot in a way that I don't now that I have a car, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or that I have my own place to live, you know? And so I think like when I think the shaping that I got around that, in terms of how I have historically shown up in conflict is like a strong like caretaker, or sometimes like not necessarily appease, but like a brand of appeasing that I feel like comes from where I grew up, where it's like, oh, I'm gonna like treat this like a joke or with a light hand. Like a lot of what I notice when like I'm hit on aggressively by men is like just kind of like responding like, oh, you're the homie, because I don't want to just be like, get out of my face.
Right.
Because it's dangerous for me to do that. I remember I've seen people do that growing up, and they got punched. Yeah. And there was a young woman in the area that a couple years after I graduated from high school who got into a verbal altercation with a dude who was street harassing her, and he murdered her in front of people, right? And so I feel like my initial reaction was really in terms of conflict to like be a, like a brand of appease that was a little bit jokey and like, okay, well, I'll just treat this like we're friends and we're cool and I can't say all the things that I want to say back to you because it's dangerous, right? And then there's also the shaping that I've gotten as a woman of color around like caretaking, like, oh, I'm supposed to like fix things if somebody's not doing okay. And so I think that those were like the two kind of most practiced things. And one of the things that I think is really important that I have seen in the somatics lineage that I really, really love is like, they're like, that stuff that we learned how to do to survive is not bad. We don't need to pathologize it and be like, those are the, you know, the bad trauma responses that you got that like are, you know, if you're really going to be they get quote-unquote like healthy, you have to stop doing that because that's codependent or whatever. I've never even heard them use the language of codependence. I feel like it's much more like, okay, so you know how to do that really well. The life and the body that you've had in the world that you lived in, you learned how to do a real good caretaker or a peace thing or a towards thing or whatever, or whatever. Or actually in my case also like in a way, like I'm out of here, I don't have to stay around for this, right? But they're like, you build your possibilities in terms of healing, but also in leadership when you can increase what are the other choices potentially that you have. Sometimes you want to do a caretaker or peace thing. The world needs caretakers sometimes. And maybe you want to do that for people that you love. Do you want to do that for people that you don't love everywhere all the time? What does that impact create for you? But also, is that in alignment with who you want to be as a leader, right? And if I believe, actually, no, I don't think that brown femmes are supposed to be doing all of the emotional labor second only to black femmes, then what do I need to switch up and learn how to practice now? So I feel like as a result, of learning new practices is being actually much more clear in my like declines or requests or like in the middle of conflict being like, here's the contribution I can make in line with the vision that I have, and here's what I can't do that I'm gonna hand back to you. Or hold space for, but not try to fix, and also not pretend like I think something's okay and we're all hella homie when we're not. Which I didn't feel like I even knew how to do before. So I feel like that has been an interesting shift over time. And I'm sure the first stuff that I talked about will always be my default. Because that's, you know, decades of practice towards that. But I feel like one of the things that can be really important in terms of, like, growing spaciousness in response to our identities is like, wow, I value and appreciate my ability to care for in the middle of people in the middle of conflict, and to not try to talk them out of their feelings. I like all of that about myself, and I want to build a bigger possibility into my own identity of also I am somebody who doesn't feel like I have to do that to my own detriment or to other people's own detriment for them learning how to practice their other possibilities inside of conflict.
So like right though, I think you know what you're talking about are, you know, these different, how our different identities, right, impact not only how we like how we navigate the world, and also out of those various experiences, there's different things that we learn, right? So are there any other things that you think, in addition to this experience, right, that you've learned from RJ about how to, you know, live your life, right? Are there any, like, critical jewels or nuggets of wisdom that you think RJ has influenced in terms of the way in which you, you know, inhabit this body?
I mean, oh, God. I always joke that, like, most people who dated me up until, like, 2013 would say I'm not a naturally restorative person. Mm-hmm. And that's a joke, but it's true. Mm. Like, no one's ever interviewed them, but I am still friends with some of them. Yeah. And they do say, like, they've seen a change over time, even though we're not dating anymore and, like, within our friendship. And I feel like, you know, like, I used to think that it was a legitimate thing. I get how people get there, but it doesn't feel like a legitimate choice for me anymore. But I used to feel like, oh, it's totally fair and reasonable choice that if somebody does something to make me mad, I'm not going to talk to them. And I'm gonna make them know that I'm not talking to them, right? And I had been on the receiving end of that growing up, and it didn't feel good and would always make me want to, you know, do better, right? Yeah. So I was like, okay, so that's a thing that works. And I think, like, it works, but then it comes at an incredible cost to the relationship. And also, just nowadays, I'm just like, that's just not in line with the values that I have about how I want to be towards people that I care about. Like, the punishment, if you made me mad, is still, of course, it's not as extreme as the huge scale of the prison industrial complex and throwing people away from our communities, but it's like has a little thread of a tentacle that's connected to that that I don't feel good about anymore. So I feel like now it's gotten to the point where I don't even feel like that's an option anymore. Like, that used to be one of my go-to moves. Like, oh, I'm not going to talk to you because I'm mad at you, which really didn't make any sense, because it was like, a lot of times I was mad at you because you didn't talk to me about something. You know what I mean? And so it created just like this like big old contradiction that didn't make sense and felt crappy. Whereas now I'm like, oh, life is so much easier when I don't feed into that particular tension. There's plenty of other tensions that I could feed into, but like, it's like, oh, that actually doesn't feel like an option anymore. I might say, hey, I don't feel able to enter into a conversation with you right now about this. Can I talk to you in this many days? These are the requests of the things. Like, this was a couple years ago, but I was like, I'm upset with you. I recognize the choices that you made came from your own experiences of trauma because of what I know about your life. And I'm telling you that those particular choices are not helpful to this interaction. So I'm gonna take a pause of this many days. I have these following questions that I would like you to reflect upon, even though that was work that I could have chose not to do emotional labor wise. But I did because I cared about this person. And then coming back to the conversation later, and it was way more fruitful. And it didn't have the outcome, quote unquote, that I would have liked. Like, he didn't end up doing what I wanted in terms of the resolution of the situation. But I feel like the way the situation got resolved didn't leave either of us feeling diminished as human beings. And that's one of the things that I think restorative justice has really been incredible at, and that somatics has given me some practices towards that, is how to be in relationship and struggle through some hard stuff and maybe not always get what I wanted, but leave feeling like I have a clean heart, or like I got to be fully human and I got to hold this other person or this other people on the other side of that as also in their full, I don't even want to say humans because it's not only about humans, it's like other living beings. So human supremacy gets us into traps, so that's another show,
another lecture for another day.
But I think like I just think like I get it, restorative justice and these practices have helped me to be able to engage in principled struggle in a way where I might not always get what I want, I don't even get what I want, like, half the time sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I get to advocate for that in a way that doesn't trample on other people.
Yeah.
And the people that I care about and the beings and the land that I care about. And I all get to leave feeling still held in our wholeness.
Yeah. No, I think that's big. I mean, I think everything that you're talking about is something I've also been, as I've come under, you know, you all's tutelage over the last 3 years. Like, thinking through for myself, I know also, like, I've been socialized as a young person in my family to, when something doesn't go my way, either be passive aggressive or just ignore it. Like, we're not talking about this. I'm leaving. You can feel how you want to feel. I'm going to feel how I want to feel. And we're probably never going to address it. We're just going to act like it never happened. But, like, as I've gotten older, like, thinking through the ways in which thinking I can suppress something actually ends up impacting the ways in which I show up, right? So I think over these years, as opposed to, like, running away from conflict, like, seeing those moments as, like, moments to have a healthier discussion about, you know, how do you feel? How do I feel? How are these things impacting us, and what do we think we both need in order to be in a healthy relationship with one another? Or even, like you said, like, taking those moments to say, I'm not ready to have this conversation right now, and I actually think if we try to have this conversation right now, it's not going to be too healthy. And being comfortable with being clear with somebody that you're not ready to have a conversation, and being clear about when you're ready to re-engage. And I think I've noticed, like, how impactful it's been to give myself and give the other person that time to really think through, how are we showing up? How do we want to move forward? What do we want this to, you know, look like moving forward? And, you know, since I came into, like, trying to do those things on a more consistent basis, I've only had, for the most part, like, success. And I think it's also allowed me to...
Can I interrupt you real fast? What do you mean by success?
When I say success, once again, it doesn't mean we're both going to get exactly what we want, but I think it allows both of us to be clear that we're willing to see each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're willing to be attentive to the pain that we may have caused one another. And we're also willing to be, like, patient enough to engage in this conversation about, like, what do you need and can I meet that need, mm-hmm. right? And being comfortable with, depending on, like, the level of need, like, both people being comfortable with, well, if we can't meet that need for each other, maybe we need to reevaluate what kind of relationship we want to be in, right? Whether we're dating or whether there's a conversation about a relationship or whether we're just friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's like those are all opportunities to not feel shame about what's happening, but to just be comfortable with, you know, there is a possibility that we need to shift the way in which we engage. And that's okay if we're not ready to, or if we don't have the capacity to potentially, like, love or support somebody in the way in which they need that to be done,
mm-hmm.
right? So, I think another piece of that is also me, like, working through or being okay with the fact that, you know, being that human beings are socialized in different ways, it's not going to be overnight that somebody can learn to support me, let's say, in the way in which I need, right? So also being comfortable with the fact that, like, even when I express to somebody something that I do need, it might not change overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And being okay with that growth process, but also being clear with myself about, you know, not necessarily putting a timeline on it, but being clear with myself about at what point is it okay for me to say no, or at what point is it okay for me to say that I do want to shift in what we have going on, because mm-hmm. it's not meeting whatever that need is. And I think a major component of that is me being self-reflective enough to be clear that to be clear about, is this like a false expectation, or is this also stemming from trauma or abuse that I've experienced in the past, like wanting to sort of place this major responsibility on another human being when quite frankly it may be something that I just need to work through personally. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's like, you know, like we've been saying, it's like very complicated. It's like an art in and of itself. But I think, you know, like you were talking about in your examples, it's like letting go of this desire to be right or to be wrong or to get exactly what you want, but holding at the center of conversations about accountability, holding one another with tenderness and care. Mm-hmm. And that's going to look different depending on the situation, but like trying to think through, is there a way we can even engage conversations about accountability without harming one another further? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that you just said a bunch that I think brought up a lot for me. One is that I think you just talked a whole bunch about boundaries without ever using the word boundaries, which I love, because I feel like sometimes boundaries, just like the word accountability, gets a little overused and underdefined. But I think that kind of moving on that line of like being clear about the needs and also being clear that it's not somebody else's responsibility to ever fully 1000% give those things to you, and knowing what's your stuff and their stuff, like, and saying no or changing the agreements about a relationship, all of that is like boundary work. And I think like that's really important, because I think like sometimes one of the ways that restorative justice can be sort of misunderstood is like, oh, well, we care about relationship and needs and connection so much that like maybe we're not supposed to have boundaries because boundaries are harmful or something. You know what I mean? I'm gonna let somebody just wile out in circle. I'm not going to, but saying, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like this idea of like, there is a operating thing, and we can credit this to mass media and all sorts of lineages of like, you know, Madonna complex, all this stuff of like, oh, if you really love someone, if you really love something, you can't have boundaries. And that's just not true. I really appreciate in all the practices that I've talked about that are important to me today that they're all really clear that like, no, that's a necessary part of being in relationship. That it's like there has to be some clarity about like, what are we doing here? So boundaries can sometimes be the things that we say no to. I think a lot of times people associate it with that or a limit, but it's also just like a definition of like, here's what we're doing here. Here's what I can do and what I can't do. Here's what we can do and what we can't do. It's not only a refusal, it's also a defining of the what we're building towards.
Right.
And then the final thing is, it also made me think of like the language that you were using and the language that I've been using. I feel like I certainly think that it's associated with a particular, at the very least, level of educational access and class, right? And so I think that we have had practice with that language, right?
Yeah.
We both have gone to college, right? You're a master.
You feel me?
You're a master of education. But what I feel like the thing can be is that people are like, oh, well, then only that certain brand of people talk that way.
Yeah.
And that might be true in terms of the language that we're using, but in terms of the practices and the things that are operating underneath, I always, like, definitely when I tried to have some of these conversations with my dad, back in the day, he would be like, why are you talking like a white person right now? And was a little weirded out, right? So I had to like shift some of the language that I use so that I wouldn't use the word boundaries necessarily, because that's not a word that was like in his world, right? Not only sometimes figuratively, but also just like literally, that's not a conversation that he was having a lot. Or even like the word needs sometimes, like I feel like he was very socialized to like not really identify with like the emotional and spiritual needs that he had. Money needs, material needs,
facts,
for sure, right? So But, like, what I think has been really interesting is bringing this frame. So it's not a it's not this, like, elitist certain level of educational thing that, like, we're using this language. And that's fine because we both understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, like, it tends to be lots of people who listen to podcasts use this kind of language. You know what I mean? And, like, eat a lot of frozen yogurt or whatever the demographics and audience research would say. But, like, I feel like the principles underneath it and the practices underneath it, if... like, are really actually very deeply worthy and accessible for everybody, even if they don't have that same level of privilege that I know that you and I have been able to gain access to. So, like, at first, when I didn't make that switch around the language, it weirded people out in my family. But then over time, as, like, I just was like, okay, so that's not resonating with them. What else can I do? But I'm still being, like, kind of bringing full circle back to the beginning where it's like it's about a way of being. Like, how does that impact my relationships? And so even, like, my family members who are like, I would never have thought would be able to, like, enter into, like, restorative ways of being, not because of their lack of class privilege or educational privilege, but just because, like, the way that I had always seen them shown up, like, oh, they're never going to be down for this. It's always going to be somebody gets cussed out. But, like, repeatedly over and over again, trying to show up and have this way of being did impact our relationship to what, with one family member. At some point, I told her something, and, you know, usually her response as a way of supporting me would just be like, well, you better tell that, and I'll go tell her. You want me to tell her? And then she was like, what did she say? She was like, I'm sorry. That sucks. Like, what can I do for you? And that was never a response that I had gotten before, but I feel like it was, like, being in that practice of, like, embodying that a bunch of times for her that, like, eventually, like, I I screenshotted that text because I just always was like, oh, the way that we're always going to engage, whether it's us against each other, or us against the world, is oppositional. And sometimes oppositional is important. Sometimes things need to be opposed. But also, I feel like there's a way to bring this into our way of being, no matter who we're interacting with, that is really accessible and not classed in a way that I think it, like, usually gets classed. And I just, I hate the idea of this being like, oh, people, white people or people with education are the only ones who get access to restorative justice, especially because this stuff didn't come from those people to begin with.
No, I think that's real. I think, you know, as you bring up these stories about family, very recently, when I had got this, I had finally found this children's book on, bodies, like, consent, boundaries, and respect, right, for children. And I had been thinking for years, like, I wanted our extended family, I wanted us to begin having conversations about this as adults and for young people. And I had been thinking, like, how do I introduce, right, such a topic to, like, to my family, right? Even though I know it's extremely important for these conversations to be happening. So this last Easter, I was like, you know, I'm gonna just bring the book to Easter. And then, you know, after folks are done with the prayer, I'm just gonna make an announcement of this book that I have. And I was like, yeah, you know, as opposed to, like, using all of the, you know, fancy language, just letting people know, like, I want us to think through what does it look like for us to raise strong children. And, like, to raise children who feel like they can say yes and feel like they can say no, and they understand, like, their body and understand that they can have boundaries, and they can, you know, have the relationships built within a family to have adults that they can confide in when they don't feel comfortable going over somebody's house or something like that. And particularly, I was so... I was so ecstatic or I was so happy to see how particularly all of the mothers and women in the family, like, I just told folks, I'm gonna sit it over here, right? I'm not gonna force anybody to get into a community building circle, but basically it's like an invitation if you want to check the book out. And over the course of, like, 4 hours for the rest of the night, I would see, like, the different mothers in the family, like, just flip through the pages, because one of them was concerned, right, the immediate question was, you know, is this age appropriate? Like, and I was like, you like, just feel free to check it out. And, you know, you can make that, decision for yourself. And all of them will, like, just flip through the pages, and they will have, like, one of the children next to them. And then to see the children, like, what is that? What's that book? Like, can you read a page to me? Can we read it? So I think it's, like, in thinking about, like, remembering that our families, regardless of class or socioeconomic status, like, they have the ability to understand, and they also have the desire, right, to be having these conversations, right? I think sometimes, like you're saying, people believe it takes a certain class of individual to be talking about consent and body boundaries and respect and agency and things like that. And it's like, no, everybody, I think, right, desires to be in healthy human connection, right? So what does it also look like for us as folks who are in the world of RJ to make that work accessible and to bring it back to the very communities that we grew up in, as opposed to only doing it on a 9-to-5 basis and believing that the only people that deserve access to these kinds of teachings or principles are people who could pay for a training, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and, like, just the idea of, like, there's already so much that's, like, oh, grow up, get more education than your parents, especially. Like, I definitely have more education. Both of my parents dropped out of high school, yeah. right? My mom went back later, so now she and I are kind of, mm-hmm. you know, matching, but, like, I certainly have more than they did at my age, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, the idea of, like, oh, you get access to these new tools in this certain level of education or class privilege, mm-hmm. including the language of restorative justice. And then there is I definitely think there's a common dynamic or also a pull to be like, and then these are the things that take you away from your people. Mm-hmm. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like this education or these tools or going to therapy or blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah, all these things that they didn't necessarily get access to take you away from your family and can, in a really dangerous way, like also be something that assimilates you further mm-hmm. into identifying with people who are trying to mess your family up
yeah.
because they're on the other side of that class or education gap. Yeah. But I think what is really cool about these things, if they're held with integrity and in alignment for the vision that we want to have with the world and with our communities, like, no, these are the things that we come back with. One, we come back with them sometimes. Two, they help tune our eyes and ears and our perception to understand how these things were always there the whole time, yeah. but we didn't know
Facts.
What they looked like.
Yeah.
And just because they don't call... So it's like a contribution of what we've learned if there's something new, but mm-hmm. also an attunement to be able to see how those things were already existing.
Yeah, yeah.
So that there's stuff where that we don't have to reinvent the wheel and be like the elitist college kid
right.
I've come back with my
exactly.
poverty solution
right.
where it's like, oh, actually you read one textbook while you were at school. But then you go back and you're like, oh, wait, I'm hell motivated because actually this is how they're showing like
right.
before whatever ugly produce happened or whatever those boxes of like, I don't know. You know what I'm talking about? Where it's like community supported agriculture
yeah.
before it became formalized. Community supported agriculture was literally the way that everybody where
right.
we were from lived.
Right.
And they did not call it that.
Right.
So, yeah, stuff like that like this helps, I think, have an attunement to a way of being that's not only about a set of tools, but also to have a deeper respect and honoring of how these things were already existing
mm-hmm.
in the places we came from.
Yeah.
And they just weren't necessarily called the same things.
Yeah.
And so, like, how can we really bow to that, too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I know we've been, you know, dropping the mic like a bazillion times and already, highlighting so many important things. Is there anything else, though, that you would suggest that folks who are interested in RJ need to know or need to seek, right? I know we've been talking about boundaries. We've been talking about the purpose of sharing stories in order to build community. We've been talking about generative somatics and all of these different lineages of practice and thought. Is there anything else you would suggest that folks need to know that are interested in this work?
Well, I would start by saying that I definitely feel like there's already things, and I know that you're not saying this to the contrary, but there's a ton of things to kind of harken back to the last thing I said that they already know.
Right.
So, like, trying to put this lens or this frame as a way to look at what they already know is, has been helpful for me.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, not every, but lots of teenagers go through this, like, I can't wait to get away from this family or this spot. And then this has been helpful for me in moving past that particular mind age and going back and being like, there was things that were hard for me. And then here's all the, like, richness and connection of things that like, have made me who I am that are incredible resources. So there's things that people need to know, and there's also hella stuff that people already know. That they might not even know that they know, or, you know.
I get what you're saying.
I just said the word no 18 times, but yeah. I think the other thing is, like, when we're really thinking about scale, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but, like, thinking about scale, that really having a constant piece of, like, the individual inner work of the stuff that we have to look at, and somatics is one tool for that. Meditation is one tool for that. Particular spiritual practices are tools for that, because I think, like, one piece that's been really important to me that I've seen grow a lot even in me and you's work is, like, the role of self-trust and, like, doing your own internal stuff so that you can be flexible and responsive to what is happening in the moment, if that makes sense. So, like, I feel like, you know, I was just watching a panel about transformative justice the other day that I think was held at Barnard and was facilitated by Jairus Dixon, who's a really incredible thinker in the TJ world, transformative justice world, where, like, one of the conversations that all these incredible minds who have been practicing and thought leading on transformative justice were talking about, like, being able to draw the distinction of, like, what is a harm and what is abuse, like what are, when it was a very nuanced conversation that I think was very brave of them to have, but I feel like one of the things that they were kind of were touching on is, like, if you don't do your own healing work and building up your own, like, self-trust stuff and your own, like, really the internal work, it can start to be trap a little bit, that lots of things start to look like harm and abuse when it's like, actually, no, that's conflict and that's a different thing. And so what they were saying was, like, you know, sometimes, like, in movements, there's people who are in conflict who are supposed to be, quote unquote, on the same side in terms of the larger movement work that we're trying to do, and then they have a conflict and then it gets termed as harm or abuse. Wow. In a way that can cause a lot of splitting. And this is in no way to minimize abuse or harm that does need to be attended to, but also that that practice of discernment, and this is like the, like, black belt next level judo ninja level work that I think that is in front of us as restorative justice or TJ practitioners also, where it's like, how to help us do our enough of our internal work that we can be discerning about what we're calling harm and abuse. Because that way we don't kind of minimize the things that are actually abusive. And then we learn to hold conflict not only well, where we're not conflating it with other things that are, that they're not necessarily, but also that we can hold conflict as, and this is another principle inside of GS, that conflict can be generative. That it actually moves us somewhere further along path towards what we're trying to build. And I think when we're not holding conflict well and everything is a harm because there's just, like, so much pain that we're moving around with, it can slow down the movement on the path. And so I even feel, like, nervous to bring this piece up, but I think it's a real thing that we're struggling with. And part of what I think would attend to it, and what I also heard the panel members say, so I'm not, like, completely plagiarizing them, because I think this is also something I've been worrying about a lot recently, is, like, what is the stuff that we have to figure out how we're going to hold internally in our own spirits and in our own, like, our own resources from our own ancestors and lineages to, like, help be able to be discerning so that we're not putting out a request or a demand for that the space or the collective has to provide for every single thing that will make me feel safe.
Yeah.
Because that's not actually possible. It's a beautiful, important thing to hold people's needs and hold people's, like, desire to experience safety as really precious. And that's not something that can be totally given from the outside. It's like a exchange and a balance of generating safety from the inside, which is another really deep set of practices from politicized somatics, generating safety and figuring out how to create that from within in partnership with the living world outside of us. That's not only people, it's also the land.
Yeah.
And how do we navigate that is a huge, gigantic piece of work, but that will get derailed if we aren't able to do our piece to hold conflict as generative and over-labeling harm and abuse when it's actually something else that's a little bit more complicated.
Wow, we're going to have to come back to that in a later episode. That's a very critical conversation for movement spaces and social justice.
I thought of one more thing in relationship to that.
Go ahead.
I think is, like, important. The idea, and this is one thing that I would add as, like, a practice that I found really incredible inside of our team and the work that we're offering as restorative justice practitioners, there sometimes can be a tendency where it's like, I feel triggered, we have to stop the show. And I think sometimes that's true. Sometimes we're so overwhelmed and so activated that our systems can't function in a way that feels like we're able to keep our dignity or our belonging or feel safe in a space. That's true sometimes. And sometimes it's like, I am uncomfortable or I am activated. I love the language that Gilbert Salazar, who's another team member, has brought, really us using regularly. It's like, I'm feeling activation in my system, but that's not the same as I'm being harmed or it's not the same as I'm, because activation, what I love, has some more possibility. Triggered is associated with a gun goes off, somebody gets shot, a deer gets killed. Look, we, you know, it's like, it has a lot of,
I get what you're saying.
Like, this idea of triggered being like, I feel triggered and then we're done. I just think that RJ, what I love about it is, like, really, like, the real fact is we're never done. Even when we have a closure or a boundary, the larger arc of the work is not done because we are alive. And aliveness is also a big practice that we're working towards cultivating and allowing inside of somatics. So I feel like the other piece of that is, like, that restorative justice can be is a place where we're building containers where people can feel activated and feel uncomfortable and feel like, oh, there's some edges that I'm rubbing up against. That's not the same as I feel triggered and now everything just gets shut down. I think sometimes that's the move, but sometimes that's not the move. And I what I love is that we're trying to build places and make contributions and support people to build containers and communities where people can be working on their growth edges and their spaces of discomfort and sometimes be triggered and stay in connection and sometimes be triggered and still have belonging. And, you know, I just think that that is a big piece. And Prentice Hempel is a really amazing healing justice leader and also a somatics practitioner and teacher who has talked a lot about that. And I feel like when I heard him talk about it, it reminded me a lot of the conversations that we've had when we're trying to also build spaces for people to be able to engage with that and not just like, I'm triggered and I'm done. Harm happened and I'm done.
Yeah.
Harm happened and you're out, because that gets really slippery slope to disposability, and we have a really strong commitment that no one is disposable. Doesn't mean we don't have boundaries,
right?
But we're holding that no one is disposable.
Wow, thank you for that. Thank you all for joining us again at What You Know About RJ, Restorative Justice, Sharing Stories and Skills, a podcast of the California Conference for Equality and Justice. Once again, I'm your host, Taharka Anderson, and today's squad spotlight was on Belia Mayeno Saavedra, who is the Director of Restorative Justice in Schools. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Definitely. Once again, if you'd like to learn more about the work that we do here at CCEJ, feel free to check us out at caceej.org. Once again, that's caceej.org. We're going to read a short description of an action that each team member does. They stare down at each other from across the space. The rest laugh. He plants his feet on the floor to run when he needs to, he says. Show me how many times you can do this without laughing. What do you think this action is? Find out on our next episode.